Thank you for coming to hear this story at a time when a lot of people in America have turned off to some of the news from Iraq and Afghanistan, and when my friends in the military, as they put it, say they're still at war while the rest of America has gone to the mall.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Today we welcome Kimberly Dozier, a CBS News correspondent who has worked primarily in Baghdad and has covered Iraq and the Mideast extensively for the CBS Evening News, The Early Show, and CBS Radio News. Prior to her CBS News appointment, Dozier served as chief correspondent for WCBS-TV, New York's Middle East Bureau in Jerusalem, London Bureau Chief, and chief European correspondent for CBS Radio News. She was also an anchor for the BBC's Radio World Service. She's written for the Washington Post and for the San Francisco Chronicle. In 2008, Dozier received a Peabody Award, as well as three American Women in Radio and Television Gracie Awards in 2000, 2001, and 2002. She is a graduate of Wellesley College and holds a master's degree in foreign affairs from the University of Virginia. On Memorial Day 2006, while reporting on a story in Baghdad, Dozier was gravely wounded in a car bombing, but recovered after multiple surgeries and many excruciating months of physiotherapy. Today, she will discuss this experience in her new book, Breathing the Fire, a brave account of her story of survival and recovery, and of the challenges of covering the war in Iraq. A book signing will follow this forum. Please join me in welcoming Kimberly Dozier.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming to hear this story at a time when a lot of people in America have turned off to some of the news from Iraq and Afghanistan, and when my friends in the military, as they put it, say they're still at war while the rest of America has gone to the mall. I think that's a little harsh, but you know, as we like to say in my business, never let the truth spoil a good story. Now, I started out as a graduate student here midway through the start of my journalism career in hopes of going overseas and showing people what was going on with a clear lens without getting opinion in the way, to try to make what's happening in the Middle East relatable to folks back here in a way that will make them care and pay attention. And when I was doing that on a small scale as a freelance reporter, it was rewarding, and at times it was pretty easy. I could say what I wanted. I could write what I wanted. Then 2003, I became the network reporter for CBS News in Baghdad. This was stepping through the looking glass. I became a reporter under siege, covering a war that was extremely unpopular or extremely popular, depending on your political point of view in this country. And I got hammered. If I did something about a story about a hospital being opened or repaired by the U.S. military, I was slammed by some as a cheerleader for the war. As one put it, a corporate pimp for George Bush's illegal war in Iraq. Ouch. If I went to a car bomb scene and reported on how Iraqis felt with their lack of security, that once again something had ripped through the fabric of their lives, stolen their loved ones, and that they were angry at the Americans for it, and I put that on the air, again, trying to be that clear lens, I got hammered by the other side. What are you, an anti-patriot, a terrorist cheerleader, feeding into the ranks of the militants' propaganda? Well, no, this is what people were telling me. Now, I wasn't the only one under siege. The people I was interviewing were also increasingly under siege. It started with the American commanders I was interviewing. they started seeing things change on the ground. And this is when this metamorphosis started happening. You know, the media and the military at first were like this in Iraq. And especially me being from CBS, the rather biased network, I couldn't get the time of day for most of the commanders. Bremer never granted me an interview. His spokesman would barely ever return my calls. And the military folks were suspicious of me because they did think that I was out to get them. But I started seeing their reactions to what they saw on the ground change. The first year, I knew more than they did. The second year, they were catching up. And by the third year, a lot of the commanders were teaching me things I didn't know about Iraq or the Middle East. And we also started moving towards each other in terms of our opinions about what needed to happen, what needed to change. And when I talked about them being under siege, well, one general I went and interviewed had realized that his guys were getting attacked by the Ba'athists, the Ba'athist army officers who'd been fired, who'd been let go by the U.S. administration, by the U.S. coalition. So he had engineered a meeting where he invited all these Ba'athist generals to come meet with him. He wasn't going to pay them off. He wasn't offering them jobs. He couldn't under coalition law. But he wanted to, in an Arab, Middle Eastern way, reach out to them and ask their advice, to ask them, how do I get your younger officers who have no jobs and are disgruntled, and I understand that, but how do I get them to stop building these roadside bombs that are blowing us up? And I thought, wow, this officer, he gets it. And I put this story on the air. Oh, he got it all right from the Pentagon. Rumsfeld's office was furious. They said it looked like he was an apologist to the people we had defeated. And this poor guy didn't talk to me for a couple of months. And there I was trying to tell a good news story, and there he was just trying to react to what he was seeing on the ground. Another general that I went and interviewed out in Ramadi, a guy named Chuck Swanick, who later became one of the generals who wrote a letter against the war once he'd retired. At the time, when I met him, he was just looking at what was going on around him, saying, you know, in an interview to us, this looks like the beginnings of an insurgency, and so we probably should change how we're fighting it. Again, wow, we put that on the air. He got rockets. It took a while before it became acceptable back in Washington to say the kind of things, to express the ground truths that either I was seeing on the ground or these commanders were seeing on the ground. And that's the funny way we started moving towards each other. And then I really accidentally stepped through the looking glass in Memorial Day 2006. Now, it had become increasingly difficult to tell the story of Iraq because it had gotten more and more dangerous. Foreigners were getting targeted. That meant we had to add more security, and that cost a lot of money. In the meantime, back in the States, where we measure ratings minute by minute, people were turning off to this story. And my bosses were saying, why should we put your lives at risk, our reporters? Why should we keep spending $1 million plus a month to tell a story that Americans don't want to hear about? So that's the atmosphere I was facing right before this Memorial Day shoot. And my camera crew, Paul Douglas and James Brolin, we met the night before, and Paul had reminded me of his age-old saying, don't risk my life unless we're going to make air. Well, this was the one time we knew we'd make air. Memorial Day, when folks back in the States are going to barbecues, enjoying the sales at the malls. It was the time to be with U.S. troops on the ground, seeing what they were doing on a day like that. And we knew that we would get on the early show. We knew we would get on the CBS Evening News. So we all agreed that's what we were going to do that day. I did not know that through that day I would end up living the tragedy that many U.S. troops and their families go through, and in a sense, sharing in part of their sacrifice. And having the privilege of meeting all the people who put you back together. So that was the next part of my story. We were going with Captain James Alex Funkhauser. He was a young Army captain with a wife and two little girls back in Texas. He said that they were going to go and have a barbecue by the lake that day. He said the hardest part of his job was leaving them behind. And this is the brief impression I had of the man before we went out the door. We were going on what was supposed to be a joint patrol with the Rockies, and they were going to show us parts of the Karada in Baghdad, an area so safe they were about to hand it over to full Iraqi control. You remember the whole point of the story? You know, as they stand up, we stand down. So it was a perfect Memorial Day, pardon the expression, dog and pony show that had been planned for us. And I was worried, actually, that it was going to be too rose-colored glasses, you know, everything's going right. And then Captain Funkhauser started talking about some of the difficulties that he was facing. He said, look, part of the reason that we're doing this today, the first stop we're taking is where a roadside bomb went off yesterday. Now, the Iraqis don't like going back into an area where there's been an attack. So in a sense, we're going back into the water, showing them it's safe to go there. And he said, you notice, they're not ready. They're not ready to go, so we're going to have to leave on our own. I now suspect maybe there were other reasons that the Iraqi patrol didn't show up with us. But with that, we got into our Humvees, and we headed off for the first stop in the Karada. We all got out of our Humvees because what Captain Funkhauser wanted to do was to talk to the Iraqis on that street. The other purpose of this trip was, he said, he knew the people in that neighborhood, and they knew whenever a stranger moved in. So he said, if an insurgent cell has moved in, these people know who it was, who it is, they know who planted that bomb. I need to look them in the eye, and they will not be able to lie to me face to face. So that is how we ended up parked about a mile from where that famous Saddam statue fell over, in a neighborhood that was supposed to be so safe, walking into an ambush. They apparently knew we were coming. They waited, looking at us from an apartment building above, until we were all within, say, 20 to 30 feet from a 500-pound car bomb. The insurgents were not watching from a villa next door to us, which is where Captain Funkhauser thought they might be. As we walked to a tea stand where his translator was already engaging some Iraqis in conversation, Captain Funkhauser had said to me, see that bombed out villa next to us? We think the insurgents are in there. They could be watching us right now. Well, he was right, but they were actually about four stories up in another building. So when we all got close, the command detonated the 300 to 500 pounds of explosives with a cell phone. And that blew burning shrapnel through us. And with that, we all stepped to the other side of this story. And in a sense, I started living the story I'd always been trying to tell. Those car bombs that I always used to hear going off from my hotel room or from the press conference where we were covering some general's interview. You'd hear these distant explosions. Now we were at the center of it. Captain Funkhauser was killed instantly, and so was his translator, Sam. And so was James Brolin, our sound man. Paul was gravely injured, as was I, with burning shrapnel to our legs. And I remember sort of getting slammed backward into black. I could smell sulfur. I knew it was an explosion of some sort, didn't know from where. And I instantly started thinking a couple things. First of all, why can't I move? And second, where are Paul and James? You know, they were my team, they were my frame of reference. And as I came to enough to, not that I ever really lost consciousness, I guess, but as I was able to start moving my head and lift it, I saw a burning car. Luckily, I could not see my body. I could not see my legs or the ruin that was left of them. And I couldn't see Paula James. I could hear people calling out for help and screaming in pain. And voices twisted by pain, you don't know who they are. And I started thinking out loud to myself, should I call for help? Because if I call for help, I know a casualty who calls for help proves that of the ABCs of triage, airway, breathing, and circulation, you've got airway and breathing if you can talk. And so the medic won't come to me. If I stay quiet, the medic will come to me. But my legs are burning, and I looked up and I saw this burning car, and I thought, well, that means I'm in immediate danger, so I can call for help and ask to be removed from immediate danger. These are the kind of things your brain does while it's in shock. It tries to take over. Meanwhile, around me, this troop of guys was seeing their captain is down, their staff sergeant is down, four more soldiers are injured, two of them gravely, and they are just trying to keep it together and keep us alive. Meanwhile, a unit of the Iowa National Guard happens to be driving by. They run into the scene when they hear the explosion. You know, they don't care that there's a burning Humvee where the ammunition is starting to pop this way and that. They just run right in to help us. And they spent the next hour fighting to keep us all alive. Now, the Iowa National Guardsmen who got to me and to Paul, they didn't think either of us would live, but they were not going to let us die alone. And they fought for us just as if we were their own. Now, Medic Lacey Presley was with Paul, and so was a staff sergeant named Paul Heberlin. And Lacey tells me they will never forget the look on his face when he finally passed away. She's back in Baghdad with another unit, afraid that it will happen to them. She cannot read my book. She cannot relive that day. She deals with that day by putting it away and not thinking about losing that life that was slipping away in her hands. And on the other side was me, bossing around my poor staff sergeant. I'm O positive. Do you need a bandage? I've got a bandage in here in my pocket. Do you need it? No, do you need another one? You're fine? Okay. Do I have my helmet on? Because I can hear shrapnel popping from the car bomb, I think. I don't want any shrapnel to hit my head. He must have been like, lady, okay. Shrapnel in your head right now is the least of your problems. Here's what was wrong with me, and here's one of the good news stories of this war. I had a small piece of shrapnel to my brain. I had two shattered femurs, one of them shattered in three places. My femoral artery was nicked, and I had burning shrapnel studding my legs from my hips to my ankles. I was losing blood at a rapid rate. I remember registering that Jeremy Koch, the guy working on me, said, you know, ma'am, I'm going to put a tourniquet on. I'm like, okay, that's one leg. And I'm putting another tourniquet on. I'm like, two legs. Not good. Yeah, I didn't know how not good. Here's how not good. In 2003, if I'd gotten these injuries, I never would have made it out of the bomb scene. I'd be dead. 2004, by the time they got me to the Baghdad Casualty Hospital, they would have taken off both of my legs as just a standard operating procedure to preserve the rest of my body, because I'd lost so much blood. 2005, by the time I got to Landstuhl, my right leg had turned black. That could have meant one of two things, that it had either gone septic or that it was bruised. They had learned by the time I got to Landstuhl that if they give it another 24 to 36 hours, you risk losing the patient if it's septic, but you might save the limb. And they took that chance. So here I stand today, both legs working, reconstructed, and I'm training for a 10K, which I'm running for Team Fisher House on October 26th. So I'll send everyone the form afterwards through the Miller Center to sign up to donate. So that is one of the good news stories of the war. And the other amazing thing I learned and had the privilege of experiencing through this process was the folks from then on who took over the fight, both to keep me alive and then to get me back on my feet. I want to introduce you to a couple of them. Now, I've told you about people like Lacey Presley and Izzy Flores, the two medics at the scene, Jeremy Koch, the staff sergeant who just used his basic combat lifesaver training to try to keep me alive. Then there was Nurse Nancy Miller, the first person I woke up to in Landstuhl Regional Medical Center in Germany, with a tube down my throat, not able to speak, and not too happy about that, wondering why she couldn't understand my scrawl. She got me a pen and paper, and I saw what I scrawled later. A team of NASA cryptographers could not have figured out what I wrote. Nancy patiently kept trying. I ended up being in Landstuhl for about 7 days, which is a lot longer than people usually stay. It's normally 1 or 2 days, and then move them out, move them along. But it was a bad time in Iraq and Afghanistan, so there were several worse wounded troops coming through that needed to be shuffled on. So the great thing was my caregivers got to see me get better, and I got to know them, Nancy in particular. She was watching the evolution of the insurgents' tactics through the injuries that were passing through. It used to be limbs, and then it was like the neck. But with each improvement in body armor and the armor of the Humvees, the insurgents were learning that fewer and fewer places were still vulnerable to them. So they were going for the eyes. Now, Nancy cannot stand eye injuries, but she knew that if she showed that to her patients, she would only compound their horror, waking up having lost an eye to a gunshot wound. So after her 12, 13, or 15-hour shifts, she was getting out medical books with pictures of eyeballs. She was looking up injury pictures on the web to try to desensitize herself. She's one of the people who basically kept me sane those first few days in so much pain I didn't know how to breathe. Then I got to Bethesda Naval Hospital, and I spent a couple months there. And there it was the corpsmen and the nurses, especially, who just kept me sane. They are your lifeline at the end of a call bell. They knew when I was in pain but afraid to hit my pain button, that they needed to tell me, you won't get addicted, you need to take this, you need to stay ahead of the pain. And they would explain to me patiently over and over again. I learned, and I, you know, pretty stubborn. I don't always learn easily, especially in a situation like that. They would come in on their days off and bring Slurpees for all of us, partly because they knew that we needed the company, and partly because they knew that we would not, all the patients on Ward 5 East in Bethesda, we all grew to hate the sight of Ensure. When you are a trauma patient, your body consumes itself, and you immediately dive into the malnourished state. And so the last thing you want to do is eat, and the thing you most need to do is eat. So there would be the corpsman, you know, saying, okay, here's a Slurpee, or I just smuggled some chocolate chip cookies up. And they just knew, because they'd been in our situation by living our situation for a year, 2 years of their lives. There was Carol Petrie. Lieutenant Commander Carol Petrie was a physiotherapist. Now, I don't know if anyone in this room has ever had physiotherapy, maybe after knee surgery. Physiotherapists, they tortured kittens as children. And this is a skill that they then apply to their patients throughout the rest of their lives. What was happening to me was when you get a head injury and then blast breaks whether it's an amputee stump or all the shattered bones that I had, what often happens is the body overheals. It sends some crazy messages to the bones. And they don't just heal, they start overhealing like coral, sending spikes into your muscles and spikes into your joints. And in order to keep those spikes from fusing my knees, the orthopedic surgeon walked in and gave us two choices, said to my physiotherapist and me, with my dad standing there. So we can do this one of two ways. You have 2 weeks to get those knees bending to, I think it was 45 degrees, and I was at 20 at that point, or we will put you under full anesthesia and break the joint. I'm like, what? Break the joint? Yeah, we'll just break through all of those little bits of coral that are trying to fuse, because they've got to be broken or your knees won't bend. And they said, but that part will be very painful for you to recover from, and there'll be a lot of scar tissue. So it's up to you. With that, we had a mission. Carol was not going to let me have to go under anesthesia. For that. What I didn't understand this meant was a long, slow, drawn-out series of painful, well, it was torture sessions. So they had to give me extra painkiller, and then Carol would come in, lift my knees, and just start bending. And I would scream through gritted teeth, literally. This is where you get the tension between the caregivers who take care of you and the caregivers, generally your family, who don't know how to let go. You needed them so much in the beginning, but eventually they've got to step back. So we had to lock Mom in the waiting room and close both double doors to my room so she couldn't hear me scream. Slowly but surely, my knees bent and I got back on my feet. The next step was going through the grief and the guilt, losing my colleagues. My parents did not want me to feel that pain. I needed to go through it and talk about it. In the end, I didn't develop post-traumatic stress disorder. I did not continue to have the nightmares or the flashbacks that are common in the first month after trauma. They're the brain's way of dealing with things. And I have since talked about that whenever I get the chance, because troops won't, and I don't mind. But I had to push through well-meaning caregivers, my family, who wanted to save me from that pain. There are some things, though, you just have to go through. In the end, what I learned coming out at the other side was the military took me in. I understood a lot of what they've been going through, why they feel so bitter when people say, we support the troops but not the war. They're like, how can they support us but not the mission that we're dying for? And I say that without passing judgment on the mission, but simply trying to open some paths to understanding, the understanding that was thrust upon me, whether I wanted to hear it or not, on my back in a hospital bed. I have been privileged to meet people like Jennifer Funkhauser, Captain Funkhauser's widow. And she has tried to explain to me how she's made sense of all of this. As I've come out the other side and tried to turn this tragedy into something positive, I followed her example. She said she was very angry initially that her husband was lost, most likely because he was a great spokesman. He was very articulate, and we'd asked for an interview. So that is probably why he was assigned to us that day, and that's why he ended up on that street. But she said she got to a point where she realized if the American public, hearing one dead, two dead, three dead, thought of him and got to know what those numbers meant through his life, then that was what he had set out to do from the very beginning. And I just want to end before we go to Q&A with something that she wrote for me, which sort of sums it all up. I've said how great he was as a father, husband, friend, and son. I've talked about his love of life and his willingness to help anyone who needed it. It gets to the point sometimes where it almost seems like I'm glorifying him in a sense, which he would hate. The truth is, Alex was all those things, but he was also simply a man doing his job. He signed up for the Army in 1991, knowing full well what he could be called to do. He moved his family to a base that he knew would send him to Iraq. This was his mission, and he was going to fulfill it. I'm proud of what he accomplished in his 35 years, and I'll never let my girls forget him. So through this experience, I will never forget Captain Funkhauser or any of these people who put me back together, and I will never think of war or covering war in the same way. And I understand when they ask us, the troops ask us, not necessarily to agree with them, but at least give them a hearing, let them explain what they're trying to do, and respect how hard they're fighting for it. Thank you very much.
I'd like to begin the conversation by asking, there's been increasing talk about the state of the U.S. military and whether it is stretched too thin, fighting on multiple fronts. And I was hoping you could give us your on-the-grounds perspective of how you saw the state of the military during your time in Iraq and sort of speculate about how you think it's doing now.
Actually, my current assignment gives me a lot more insight into that. Admiral Mullen is quite blunt. We don't have enough troops to fight everything that's on our plate right now. They need more troops in Afghanistan. They're only going to get maybe a third as many as he thinks is necessary to their this year. We are fighting a two-front war with no reserves left for anything else, and it is taking a massive toll on the folks in uniform. Now, they are signing up, they're re-enlisting at record numbers. So there is obviously this amazing camaraderie that keeps them taking those risks, despite the multiple deployments, despite the risks of their job, despite losing so many friends in the process. And also, especially if they're among the officer corps, despite really doubting what they set out to do in Iraq, or how they set out to win the war in Afghanistan. There's a lot of internal question going on. The other thing that it's taking a huge toll on are the military families. Multiple deployments are not kind to marriages, and they're not kind to kids growing up. Kids are growing up without their mom or their dad. And so that's why some of the commanders especially are frustrated when they hear some of the more simplistic slogans, get us out of Iraq, as opposed to, get us out of Iraq in a phased way, et cetera, et cetera. Get us out of Iraq. You think we want to stay in Iraq? This is killing us. And yet they don't want to leave the job. Many that I speak to don't want to leave the job, as they put it, undone, just because of all the folks who've gone before them and given their lives for it, and all the Iraqis who have given their lives for it as well.
We refer to PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Is it a disorder or is it an injury?
Combat stress is an injury. It can develop into post-traumatic stress disorder. As much ignorance about this subject as anyone else in the very beginning when I ended up in that hospital bed. I did not understand that the brain's way of dealing with trauma is often reprocessing whatever awful thing you went through in the form of nightmares, repetitive thoughts, flashbacks, and that if you experience those things in those first few weeks, that first month after the trauma, that that's actually absolutely normal. That it is not called PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, unless it continues after that period. So I asked, you know, once I understood that, I asked the psychologist that I had spoken to at Bethesda, that I'd insisted on speaking to, because I didn't want, there are a couple theories. Some people go towards the psychiatrist route, take antidepressants until you're better physically healed and then able to tackle the mental part of things. Oh, I like to do everything all at once. I'm like, no, I'm in pain, but I also want to talk about all this horrible stuff I'm feeling. So the psychologist I spoke to, I said, well, you know, why didn't I get PTSD then? And he said, well, if you remember, we couldn't shut you up. From the moment I woke up in Landstuhl, when Nancy handed me that pen and paper, I was writing what I could remember. And my mom was furious when she found out that I was writing things down. I mean, her first instinct was, you know, try to make her forget. Is there anything you can give her to make her forget? And that's often the first instinct of either commanders in the field or someone who's been through something like this. Put it in a box, put it away. Well, the problem is, if you've gone through multiple deployments, you got too many boxes stacking up. And at some point, my personal opinion is you got to open it up, the sooner the better, before it becomes a problem. I try to explain now when I talk to military commanders, who many of them are of the old-fashioned bent. They think that PTSD is something that has been created by young soldiers or by the Vietnam vet generation that doesn't really exist, or is being hijacked by young soldiers who want to get out of doing their duty. And I try to tell them, okay, look, sure, human nature, there might be a small percentage of people doing that, but let's think about this. You've got a very young force of people going into a meat grinder in two different countries. They're often sitting ducks with no control over their own fate. They don't know when they might be blown up. And they're doing this again and again and again. And this is often, you know, if you're 19 or 20, this is your first series of hard knocks. When I got hit, I turned 40 in Bethesda. I had gone through the soul-destroying process of becoming a network correspondent. I mean, I had survival skills. So, I had something to fall back on. And so I try to point out to these soldiers, you know, look, I'm generally talking to officers or NCOs who've been in uniform for 20 years. I'm like, you all have been through it. These kids haven't. And then the other thing is, we've got to get to the point where we don't think about it as something that is something to be ashamed of. I try to explain it more like, okay, you know, when you go to the gym, and then I usually get a lot of nods from the sergeant majors. Yeah, okay. Go to the gym, you work out too hard, and you sprain a muscle. Some people sprain the muscle, the other person doesn't. You both do 25 push-ups, one of you gets a sprain, the other one doesn't. We don't know why, but you know, if you push through that sprain instead of stopping and letting it rest, you're gonna cause greater injury, which can become permanent. Bad idea, you know. So start thinking of combat stress as that strain, you know. So recognize it in your troops, let them have a rest, and then let them get back to the fight. Don't push them through it. What I have learned about PTSD is that, especially, for instance, in the Vietnam vet generation, it wasn't recognized for a very long time, for years. So because it didn't get recognized early on, it can become a part of your life that you cannot get rid of. You know, those pathways in your brain get fused. And in terms of, you know, the nightmares become permanent. You don't break that pattern early enough to keep it from getting set in. So we don't want that to happen with this generation of troops. And that's why I've decided, okay, well, I didn't develop PTSD, and I don't really, talking about the subject is very uncomfortable, because in my family, we don't talk about how we feel, we don't talk about religion, we don't talk about, and here, and I write this, you know. Here's my life in 300 pages. But if talking about it helps those folks out there who can't, I'll go ahead and embarrass the heck out of myself up here. And also make myself a real target for the Vietnam veteran generation, because I have gotten some hate mail simply by saying that PTSD is something that I believe you don't have to get or that you can recover from, because for some of them, they'll never, ever get rid of it. And I don't want to dishonor their service or in any way make them feel like I'm saying, you just weren't tough enough. No, you just didn't get the help that we should have given you in time. So.
Your story is terrifying and extremely moving. Thank you very much for sharing it.
Thank you.
My question is the reaction to your book. Are you finding that it falls along ideological lines, that how people think about the war in Iraq marks their reading of your story and their reaction to your telling it?
I'm finding there's very little ideological reaction to the book, especially since I tried to make sure this was not a book that was for or against the war. I tried to be that clear lens of saying, you know, this was the journey of the combat injured. Here's how I was trying to tell the story of Iraq. Here's how I lived through part of the story of Iraq. And I find because I stuck to the people going through it, that most people have a very human reaction to, wow, that nurse, or that doctor, or that staff sergeant who was suddenly in charge of the bomb scene, wondering how the heck he was going to get these people out of there and keep them alive, that all that breaks through. The best reactions I've had are from parents of injured troops who have read it and then gotten in touch with me and said thank you, because, you know, I didn't know that some of this was ahead. And, you know, from now, I wanted to coddle him and keep him from trying to stand up and walking those 20 feet because I thought the physiotherapist was nuts. Now I'll let her have at it. And the other great reaction that I've had is from trauma patients who say, you know, thank you for expressing the desire to get back to normal. One of the things I haven't mentioned yet is that when you're a trauma patient, you fight really hard to get back to what you used to be. But when people, especially when people meet me, oh, you're that reporter. And out of respect and out of awkwardness, they say things like, you know, are you in pain? And they mean it in a respectful fashion. And for the first year, I reacted like an angry teenager. No, I'm not in pain, I'm fine. You know, can I help you? No, I can do it myself. You know, I've tried to take that to a more kind of mature level and understand where they're coming from. They're just trying to help. And then explain to them and to the public at large, when you've fought so hard to get well, you want people to recognize that by treating you as back to normal. And trauma patients who've had to fight the same fight have said, you know, thank you. Oh, for all the times I wanted to punch someone out. Exactly. And, it's just opening up that dialogue. Trauma is the leading cause of death in America for people between the ages of 25 to 55. So there are a whole lot of people who've never been to a war zone who've been through exactly what I've been through. And so I hope that that helps them too.
Sabah al-Khair. You are a very brave lady, and I admire you for what you have done and for your reporting. I like to make comments. Saddam Hussein was not worth the life of one of our soldiers. And today we are in a war that we don't understand the Arab mentality. We have a group of soldiers, both Iraqi soldiers and American soldiers. The Iraqi police force, may I say, and whenever they run into a problem, they will always call on the Americans to come and help them because they're in trouble. Could you please comment on this?
Depends on the soldiers, depends on the unit, as it's been explained to me. That used to be very much the case in every case. But I understand that there are some parts of Iraq where the units have become so independent that they've asked the Americans to step away. Yeah, or, you know, we'll call you when we need you. Witness Basra. Maliki engineered that little invasion in Basra to bring the Shiite militia under control without really checking with the Americans. And so the Americans did have to provide some air and logistics support later on, and maybe just a little bit of tactical advice. But for the most part, they say that Maliki did handle that on his own, and they've actually now been paying the price, because some of them say privately Maliki received such an infusion of confidence after that action that he's being very difficult to negotiate with in terms of the status of forces agreement, which has been changed to a memorandum of understanding, no, a memorandum of agreement is the official name right now. But now they're wondering if Maliki might push it to the edge. He has until around December before they have to ask for another extension of the UN mandate. And the friends I know who are negotiating the darn thing at first were saying, yeah, it's almost all done. They're agreeing to everything. And somehow this bargain in the souk is going a lot longer than anyone expected. And they're blaming the fact that the Iraqis are feeling so darn independent and like they can go it on their own. So we'll see how that one plays out. They still need American air power and American logistics power. That's going to take a while to... I think what might end up happening is that we, the coalition, might end up getting kicked out a little bit sooner than we wanted or anticipated, especially if any of the particular groups we're trying to protect right now end up on the sharp end of Iraqi government policy, on the receiving end.
Hi, Phyllis Katsheris, clinical psychologist. I really can understand the trauma that you went through. I've treated many people in similar situations, and I wonder. And also, I can empathize because I had that same kind of torture for my knees when I had, but mine was from a different kind. It was skiing, so it's a very different kind of accident. But Joe Geek was a good torturer. So, what I'm interested in is you sounded like you handled all of this with such bravery. If you could speak to what it's like and what it was like going through all this, being there as a woman journalist and being a woman with the military, and what's the woman's perspective on this?
You know, because I worked in the Middle East for so many years, and there were so many other women colleagues, I just took it as read that there were men reporters and women reporters, and I didn't really think of myself in terms of my gender covering a war. When I think back on it, though, when I'm forced to think about how it affected me, well, yes, there were certain bases, remote bases, that I wasn't going to get sent to because, you know, there were no shower facilities, and they didn't know how to handle a woman out there. One of my colleagues, Richard Engel, got to embed with some pretty remote units because he was just living with the boys. And I read his book, some of the things that he talks about. The guys wouldn't tell me that stuff, that's for sure. But at the same time, I could also, in an Arab household, I could go hang out with the women in the kitchen. So I could see another part of life that a male reporter couldn't. And there's also the, in terms of, not so much in Iraq, but in other parts of the Middle East, you have to you know, being a woman is kind of double-edged. They can be very sexist. And there were some Palestinian negotiators who only talked to me because I knew, as I could hear them say in Arabic, that they didn't quite realize I could understand, oh, it's that cute blonde one again, let her in. You know, and even as I can't believe you just said that, but okay, I'm gonna go in and take the exclusive. And I mean, that's how I got in to see Yasser Arafat, because, you know, the guy who thought I was the cute blonde would let me in to see him. That didn't happen too often. Okay, I didn't let that happen too often. It made me feel too uncomfortable to play that part of the game. I generally would wear a fake wedding ring and make up this whole fictitious, you know, husband, family, kids, etc., to sort of, you know, I am a respectable woman, not one of those American female reporters you've seen in Hollywood, you know. It was sometimes an advantage, and when it was a disadvantage, you know, I just found a way around it. And there were so many of us out there doing the same thing. Christian Amanpour was one of my colleagues and one of the reasons I got into TV. They kept telling her no, and she just kept quitting and moving somewhere else and moving up the ladder. I'm like, okay, if you can do it, Christiane, I'll try to follow in your footsteps. And at Carol Murphy at the Washington Post won a Pulitzer Prize for being in Kuwait City during the 1991 invasion. Lori Kasman from VOA taught me how to be a radio reporter. I mean, everywhere I turned, there were these strong women characters. So I'm looking forward to the time when the American public catches up with us and realizes how many of us there are out there. Thank you.
Kimberly, I'm just so touched by your story, and I'm so grateful that you are such an incredible truth seeker. You're so passionate about it. Obviously, you had to deal with the consequences emotionally and psychologically and physically of seeking the truth. I think one priceless insight that I've had today, based upon what you've had to say, is how do we actually get objective truth through the kind of kaleidoscope of either the conservative group that see you as a biased reporter or a liberal group that feels that you can't be reporting on progress that is being made. So it just seems like there's such a difficult challenge to really get the truth, objective truth, out so that all the different sides can see it. So what have you learned from this experience to maybe help all of us, give us some suggestions from your side of seeking the truth that we can listen more? Or how do we actually, as a country now, listen to objective, valuable truth?
Wow. How much time do I have? You know, I'm hoping that what Iraq has meant for us as an experience is a sort of a coming of age post 9/11. In the beginning of the invasion, in the first couple years, everything was seen very much through an ideological lens, left or right. And then I think when people started realizing this wasn't turning out, you know, how they wanted, then all of a sudden it was. In 2003 and 2004, it was hard to report that things were going wrong. I got a lot of resistance from my own bosses. I had to be very careful about it, and because they were sensitive to the fact that the public didn't want bad news. And then there was this sort of backlash in 2006, 2007, where it was like all you could report was that things were going wrong. You know, the pendulum went the other direction. And I'm hoping by now that what's happening is we've had this amazing education process. You've got a whole generation of reporters who've lived over there and gotten to know military commanders. They've gotten to know us. Diplomats, to a lesser extent, they're harder to reach. They're in the green zone. And there's a whole lot less self-delusion being allowed because we've all been there and done that. And there's a lot of pragmatism at play. Secretary Gates is one of the people who has given me hope in terms of how he's behaved in the Pentagon, the messages that he's given to his commanders. You know, yeah, tell the truth, warts and all. And if you're not going to do it, if you're not going to face up to what's going wrong, I'm just going to fire you, which he's done. Now, I've seen that message filter down in terms of generals and then colonels, then lieutenant colonels, then majors, who are far less afraid to tell me what they think now, even publicly. There's also been the private disillusionment among many ideologues, especially ideologues in the military, who tell me, yeah, that's how I fought in 2003. It did not survive contact with reality. And now you're seeing a lot of people, I think, applying pragmatic solutions on the ground. And I think you're going to see that, or you're seeing that reflected in the reporting as well. One hopes. That's what I'm pushing for.
First of all, thank you so much for coming. It's very timely, and we appreciate it. I must confess, I'm up to that point in the book, which shows that you have this delicious sense of humor with Chris Albert's Australian nurse of a mother holding off
Holding off the missionaries on the porch with the
shotgun
riot
issued
gun
by the Virginia State Police.
Yes. Like that.
That's really marvelous. But my question has to do with a point that I, it's been several months since I read that chapter, I'm sorry. It has to do with the rapport you have evidently, on the one hand, with Captain Funkhauser's widow, and you also discuss at one point your relationship with the respective widows of your colleagues, James and Paul. And as I recall, in one case it was good, in the other case it was not. And I wonder if that has changed at all, and if you, without identifying which is which necessarily, if you can enlighten us about that.
Well, both wives, as I understand it, through mutual friends, dealt with things in different ways. Jerry Brolin, basically very British, stiff upper lip, put it away and did not want to go there again, whereas Paul's wife has really been just like me with my book, in terms of very inquisitive, needed to know everything, every detail. She needed to talk to everyone who'd been with Paul in his last moments. They arranged a video conference for them to speak. I spoke to Paul's wife once very early on, and then after that, as I understand, she went through a lot of different things, all the phases of grief, which are, at first you are angry with the survivors, and then at some point it becomes, once she reaches peace or makes peace, then I realized I kept offering to be available to speak to her and to either of them or to any of their families. But I had to ask myself, that one conversation that I had with her, who did it help more, me or her? So a second conversation, is that to assuage my guilt for surviving? So I leave it to them. Jennifer and I both wanted to meet each other. And actually, the funny thing is people try to keep us apart for a bit. And now we don't talk often, but she understands. She helped explain to me why her husband was there that day and helped me recover from his loss and recover from the guilt over his loss. And she just showed amazing strength because, as I understand it, you know, in the military, they don't expect it to happen, but they understand that it can. And, you know, she's turned this into a way to honor him and his service and has forgiven me for my part in that. And that's really helped.
Hi, I also just wanted to second and say that it's a real honor and pleasure to have you here and to listen to your talk. It's been wonderful.
Thank you.
One of the questions I have is, you know, a lot of people say that when they go through a life-endangering experience that it changes them, sometimes not always for the worse, but in other ways as well. I was wondering, how do you think you've changed after going through this?
I write in the beginning of the book that it reinforced some parts of me and burned away others. I had a lot more doubts before this, a lot more doubts about what was the I cared sometimes too much about what my bosses thought about the direction of my reporting. I tread too lightly, and now I don't care as much about, you know, crashing into people's opinions like a bull in a china shop. But the funny thing is, the other way it changed me is I listen a lot more closely now to other people's reactions, responses. So while I'm more willing to offend them, I end up offending them less because I'm actually listening to what they're saying. So, listen to some reporters and listen to how much they actually listen. It's a common flaw of ours. It has reinforced that internal compass. You know, all along I can see from the reporting I was trying to do beforehand and then how I was fighting to recover throughout this, even as I had surgeons sometimes telling me I was doing the wrong thing, or, you know, the psychiatrist, or my parents saying I was pushing too hard. And yet, everything I ended up doing, I believe, was the right thing to do and the right way to go. And so now, when I run across a roadblock, I know it hasn't steered me wrong, and I will listen to it, and I urge everybody else to do the same thing. It's not always easy, but, you know, if you listen hard enough, you know the right way to go. Thank you.